that are successful. I'm going to just brief you about one of the successes. Japan, in the 1600s, Japan faced its own deforestation crisis. The so-called Tokugawa Shogunate of Japan ended 150 years of civil war in Japan, and peace and prosperity paradoxically precipitated problems in Japan, and that with peace and prosperity, the Tokugawa shoguns then began building monumental wooden palaces for themselves, gathering timber from all over Japan, and so did the daimyos, the hundreds of nobles, and with peace and prosperity, Japanese cities made of wood, built up, and the cities would periodically burn and have to be rebuilt again. So Japan began to get deforested. But the Tokugawa shoguns had decided to isolate Japan. Japan did not have foreign relations with other countries, and so the Japanese knew that they could not solve their resource problem by going and pillaging other countries. They made the decision to cut themselves off from the world. They would have to survive on their own resources. And the Tokugawa shoguns then solved their forestry problems both by negative measures and by positive measures. The negative measures included measures to conserve timber. They restricted the use to which wood could be used. They turned towards building houses on a light timber framework rather than heavy timber. They began using coal instead of wood for fuel. They developed fuel-efficient stoves and heating devices. Those were the negative measures to conserve wood, but there were also positive measures to produce more wood. Japan invented, independently of Europe, independently of Germany, which is usually credited with the development of scientific forestry, Japan independently developed scientific forestry in the 1600s, figuring out how to plant tree plantations, and so there were Japanese textbooks from the 1600s about how you plant your seedlings in a seed bed and weed them out and space them out and prune them, and here's micromanagement of Japanese farms. The result of these negative measures and positive measures is that from being an island at risk of an Easter Island-like collapse, the Japanese conserved their forests so well that today, Japan is the first world society that devotes the largest fraction of its land area to forests. 74% of the area of Japan today is forested, even though the remaining area of Japan is the most densely populated large first world society in the world. Until the 1850s, Japan was self-sufficient in wood. That is no longer the case. But the Tokugawa Japan is an example of one of the success stories, a society that recognized its problems and solved them. In working on my book, there were some major surprises for me. One surprise came when, in order to work out the material of the book, for the past couple of years I've been teaching a course on the material of the book to my UCLA undergraduate students who've been guinea pigs for the material. And my UCLA students posed questions, and they bored in on a question whose significance I hadn't appreciated. They kept asking, how on earth did these societies make these mistakes? Didn't they see what they were doing? Did the Easter Islanders see that they were deforesting their island? Did the Amazons, did the Bayas see the soil erosion and deforestation? And why didn't they solve their problems? I remember one of my UCLA students saying, what did the Easter Islander who cut down the last palm tree say as he was cutting down the last palm tree? And it's a key question that I have to work with. Why do societies make fatal mistakes? So chapter 14 of my book ended up as a longish chapter on the general question of failures of decision making. Not only past societies, but universities, at least the University of California, and some governments, and some small groups, have been known to make mistakes. The reasons why a group may carry out a self-destructive policy turn out to be exceptionally complex and interesting. A group may fail to anticipate a problem for a number of reasons, or when the problem arises, they may fail to perceive it, or when they perceive it, most surprising, they may not try to do anything to solve the problem for a whole series of reasons, or they may try to solve it and may fail to solve it. For example, a society may not anticipate a problem if they're reasoning by false analogy. The French, after World War I, anticipated World War II, but figured it would be like World War I, and so they built the Maginot Line for defense. fine against the trench warfare of World War I, inadequate against the tank warfare of World War II. The French were reasoned by false analogy. Or society may not perceive its problems for many reasons that include what's called masking amnesia or creeping normalcy. If changes are very slow, you may not see the change happen. Prime example today is climate change, global warming. There's been argument for a couple of decades about global warming, which has been recently resolved in that all scientists or climatologists concerned with climate now agree that yes, the Earth's temperature is getting warmer, and the main a major reason is human causes. But it took a couple of decades for scientists to sort this out. And the reason is creeping normalcy. It's not the case that each year the temperature was 1 degree warmer than the previous year, but that this year it was warmer, and then it got colder, and then colder again, and then warmer, and then a couple of warm years and colder years. So there were lots of ups and downs, and it took several decades for scientists to discern the trend, to discern that normalcy really was creeping and not static. And then there's a host of reasons why societies that perceive a problem may not even try to solve it. Conflicts of interest, the creation of the problem, may be good, some may profit, some small group in society. The situation called the tragedy of the commons, where there are lots of resource users and they can't reach agreement, so they all are honest. And conflicts with social values, such as religious values. This area, then, of societies failing to solve their own problems ended up for me as one of the two biggest surprises of the book. And the other biggest surprise of the book involved what I learned about big businesses. Until 7 or 8 years ago, like many people who were concerned about the environment, I thought that I viewed big businesses as evil, as the cause of our environmental problems, pursuing the bottom line, even at the expense of everybody else, and damaging the environment. And it is true that many big businesses do things that profit themselves and damage the environment. But when in 1998 I went out as a consultant to an oil field in Papua New Guinea, managed by one of the big international oil companies, Chevron Texaco, it was a shock to me because I had mainly mismanaged oil fields with oil spills and gas flares. And when I came to the Chevron oil field in Papua New Guinea, it was better managed than any national park that I've been in. Populations of endangered plants and animals are more abundant in the Chevron oil fields than outside the oil field. And the reason turned out to be that Chevron had discovered a whole series of reasons why it was in its financial interest to manage the environment extremely carefully. Those reasons included that by spending a few $1 million a year on careful controls, you avoid the risk of every now and then a $4 billion disaster like Exxon Valdez or Santa Barbara Channel blowout, that by managing the environment carefully, they reduce the risk they would get thrown out by New Guineans, they maintain the morale of their workforce, they achieve a good reputation in the world and got other oil contracts. So in short, Chevron found that it helped their bottom line to be scrupulously careful about the environment. The next to last chapter of my book looks at the reasons why some big businesses do make messes and other big businesses are far more careful than even any conservation organization can be. And the reasons are complex and they're very interesting. For example, within the United States, among various mining companies, it turns out that America's leading palladium and platinum miner is squeaky clean and has brought in Trout Unlimited to monitor the state of its trout streams. And the coal miners used to make messes until 32 years ago when there was a dam failure that ran 165 people. And the government then imposed regulations to which the coal mining companies protested to drive us bankrupt. But the regulations were passed anyway. And within a year or two, the coal mining companies stopped complaining because it turned out that yes, they could reclaim land as rapidly as they mined it. And it wasn't too expensive. This is not to say that the coal mining industry has a perfect record today. Of course it doesn't. But it has a much better record than is the copper mining industry, which for reasons peculiar to copper mining, continues to dump toxic waste into the environment. The reasons then for these differences among different types of mining companies, and for the differences among different logging companies and among different fishing companies, I found fascinating and surprising, and they occupy the next to last chapter of my book. But it was also
and power in chapter, because the concluding message of that chapter was that the behavior of the state business is ultimately demands on the public. It's in our power to influence, virtually control, what big businesses do in either two ways, by voting, and so the government passes regulation, or by consumer preference, buying from big businesses whose practices we admire, and boycotting big businesses whose practices we do not admire. And that came to the attention, for example, a couple of years ago, Home Depot, the largest wood products company in the world, which eventually decided it was in its interest to phase out wood purchases from old-growth forests and ecologically sensitive areas, and to commit itself to converting its wood purchases from well-managed, certified farms. Home Depot did that ultimately because of the public consumer preference. So all that was a surprise.